You are listening to International Open Podcast. This is the official podcast of International Open Magazine. Please head over to internationalopenmagazine.com to see the show notes size of the podcast, articles and more information.
So, can we try to open it?
Well, I should say first, this is the International Open Podcast coming for the first time from Moscow. I'm here in Russia speaking English with a Russian historian. Very excited. And I forgot the most important ingredient to be an authentic International Open Podcast, but fortunately, this guy across from me who I'm about to introduce, he listened to some of the International Open Podcasts from Vienna and heard that beer is an important part of the podcast. So he brought Russian beer. We have these cans of Russian beer that we can do. But so I don't want to wait much longer, but could you just tell me, how do I pronounce? Is it Kozel?
Is it Kozel?
Kozel.
Yes.
Kozel. So my beer is from the Czech Republic?
Yep.
And what are you about to dig into?
I think it's from St. Petersburg, somewhere near Finland.
And how would you pronounce that?
It's Baltica.
Baltica.
Yeah.
Baltica, like the Baltic Sea?
Yep, exactly.
Ah, cool.
Exactly.
So, I'm ready to open mine.
Yeah, so this is the intro.
Estrovia. Or how do you actually say it?
I've heard it so many times in American movies.
But what would
we just started to say it like in American.
So now you're saying it like Americans, trying to speak Russian.
Yeah.
That's perfect for the podcast. How would you cheer just to your friends when you're not trying to sound like an American, trying to sound like a Russian?
No давай.
No давай?
Давай. Давай. Like.
Давай. No давай.
Yeah.
Oh, I really like this. I like it. It's sort of a, maybe an amber or a dark amber. Like, it's nice.
Yeah. Kozel. Kozel.
Got to remember that. Well, I want to introduce Sergei Bondarenko. And this is Derek Breen from the USA. I've been in Moscow for a week. It's my second time in Russia. I was first here only 2 months ago, and I loved it so much that I'm back. Last time was 5 days, this time is 4 weeks. And I was introduced to Sergei by our mutual friend Vladimir, who's pulling us together for a sort of history, technology, education project. And within hours, if not minutes, we were talking about film and music and all sorts of things. And I asked him if he listened to podcasts in Russia, and he said, I listened to podcasts. I've been wanting to produce my own podcast. I even bought a microphone. And
like
so
2 days ago.
See, like right before. And so now we're recording with this beautiful blue microphone. What's the model of this microphone?
They called it the Yeti.
Ah, yes, the Yeti.
And, you know, maybe it's all advertisement, but it was the first one which I saw from all these, you know, articles about how should I podcast, like, properly.
Yeah.
You should use Blue Yeti for Blue and all the stuff. So I think it was really not hard to choose this one because it looks like, right, you know, a little bit like R2-D2 from Star Wars.
I was thinking it looks like an Oscar. It's about the height of an Oscar award. But yeah, now that you say it, it is like R2-D2 or like those droids that would attack the Jedis in the early prequels.
Sure, sure.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, a little bit sci-fi in it.
Yeah, I like it. I used a blue, the original blue microphone, the Snowball, which I still have, although it's a little bit glitchy, but that was revolutionary when it came out, being able to have this really sort of proper microphone.
Uh-huh.
It's cool. So could you tell me a bit about yourself? Like, what's your day job? What's the thing that pays the bills?
It's this big historical enlightenment organization called Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
Or in Russia we say just Memorial. It was founded by, you know, a bunch of guys who were interested in history of the Soviet Union. They were historians, freedom fighters. Some of them were in prisons or in camps during not Stalin's era, but Brezhnev's, most of them.
Mm-hmm.
And
can you tell us the approximate years of the Brezhnev era? Because some of our listeners were not alive when Brezhnev.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Including you.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, including you, are you are like
including me. Brezhnev came to power in 1964. It was a very painful transition after Khrushchev, and he was in Politburo during 1982, and he was completely out of his mind because of, I don't know how actually should I pronounce it in English, it was an insult. This thing with your brain, in Russia was an insult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he had a couple of these kind of things. During his
like a stroke?
He had a couple of strokes during the 70s. So basically when the war in Afghanistan began, he was like half out of his mind. There are a lot of really funny
jokes.
This is
the war in the early 80s in Afghanistan.
Yeah, exactly. Early 80s. And it's a bit funny, but still, of course, a bit tragic because he was the only leader with the power in the Soviet Union. And he was like, yeah, you can't even, you know, download the or like made a podcast with him because he was like, he barely could talk, you know, during his like 2 or 3 years, last years.
I don't know much about Brezhnev, and almost all that I know about the Afghanistan War of the 80s I learned from Rambo, the sequel to First Blood, where Rambo goes, and wasn't it that the second one where he goes to Afghanistan, or was it the third?
It's probably the third one.
Third.
It's a pretty good first, actually.
Now that's a Russian historian saying a pretty good source for learning about this war is the third Sylvester Stallone Rambo film. You heard it here first on an international podcast.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that we have like I think we had some of, you know, really good movies about this war.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the most important one is the movie called Naga, or just Naga.
Naga. How do you spell that?
Noga. Naga, which means basically leg.
Oh.
And it was based on the, you know, very strange script. It was based on the version of William Faulkner's story, which was about which also called the leg.
Oh.
Probably, and it's about the man who lost his leg during the war, and in that case during the war in Afghanistan, and how he deals with this post-war syndrome, how he lived after the war in Moscow, and how he coped with this thing that like a ghost of his leg talked with him,
mm-hmm,
during his dreams or something
like
that.
Oh, wow.
It's a really, really cool movie. Yeah.
It also sounds incredibly timely when you think about all the, at least I think of all the American service people who are coming back from Afghanistan with missing limbs,
mm-hmm,
now.
Sure,
it's
sure.
been happening. There was a really kind of disturbing report about how all of these medical advances are kind of allowing people to live, but with horrible, horrible disfigurements and impairments, and like at a certain level, the question is it really worth them being kept alive?
Mm-hmm.
But because the medical advances have gone so far, they are being kept alive much longer. And then on the other end, there are a lot of veterans who can't qualify for disabilities,
mm-hmm,
even though they have disabilities more extreme than the disabilities of the veterans that qualified 10 or 20 years ago, because now all these people that would have died in combat are living and requiring huge amounts of money to sort of rehabilitate, keep them alive,
mm-hmm,
all that sort of thing. So and the fact that it's the same country is that history repeating itself, like, literally.
Yeah, and it also leads me to, you know, to this, I just heard, or maybe I've heard it in a podcast, I think, from National Public Radio, mm-hmm. that they have a very special technique how to deal with this nightmares of the veterans, how they just try to teach them how to use their mental skills, how to prevent these dreams, how to just woke up from the dream if you had this kind of dream, and how should we manage these things with our own not post-war or post-war lives.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, especially I'm a veteran of mm-hmm. Desert Storm who had dealt a bit with post-traumatic stress for a few years after that, mm-hmm. and so I'm always curious. Like one of the things that I read about with post-traumatic stress fairly recently is this trend of discouraging the previous practice for post-traumatic stress was analysis, going deep, really trying to expel the demons. And more recently, researchers are saying that people are being re-traumatized as they explore that experience after the fact. Mm-hmm. So in fact, the very thing that people have been doing intentionally might be deepening or extending post-traumatic stress rather mm-hmm. than alleviating
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
not just for veterans, but...
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Because, you know, we in Memorial, we have to deal with these things, you know, like a lot. Because we have a lot of problems with our own Soviet history and with these guys who came from Chechnya in the mm-hmm. 90s. And one of the greatest thing that I've heard about it, probably, it was maybe 1 year ago when American researcher, her name was Katie Carut,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote some really important books about trauma and how to deal with trauma, and he gave us a lecture about it, and it was really, really great, and she told a lot of very important things. It was a little bit maybe nerdy, or like post-Freudian, maybe. She talked a lot about these dreams and how it really worked,
mm-hmm.
but it still was really, really informative for me. Now I still thought about it, you know, from time to time.
What is your role with Memorial?
Mm-hmm. Now I just have to write some articles for their mm-hmm. website, so it's maybe kind of journalistic work. From time to time I go to exhibitions or reading some books and making reviews or watching some historical movies or documentaries about history and write reviews. I'm also working with the Memorial Exhibition Place, and we will have, I think, in a month or two, very good exhibition about Varlam Shalamov.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know him?
No, I don't.
He is, you know, very, very, very important guy for our literature and history. But, you know, in the world scale, he's in the shade of Solzhenitsyn. Because Solzhenitsyn was the main guy.
Yeah.
But Shalamov was the true guy.
How do you spell his last name?
Shalamov.
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 I've never heard of him.
There is a very good English translation, I think, of his books.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a lot of short stories about his time in Колыма, called Колыма Stories, basically mm-hmm. Колымские рассказы. And you know, I think the last Nobel Prize winner in literature, called Svetlana Alexievich, she's from Belarus. She just told that Varlam Shalamov, for her, is the most important writer in 20th century.
Oh, wow.
So we were just cool. Wow, that's yeah. cool for our exhibition, really.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that.
When and where is the exposition going to be?
It would be in exactly in Memorial Place, which is in the center of the city, near Hermitage Garden, which is between Pushkinskaya, Chekhovskaya, Маяковская, Цветной бульвар I think it's the proper place.
And when will that be?
I hope that it will be in the end of February or maybe in the beginning of March it will start, and I think it will be for the maybe half of the year or something. It's European exhibition about Shalamov. I think it's called something like to live or to write. This is, you know, some kind of famous quote, I think from Pirandello or something like that.
And just before we started recording, you were telling me that I mentioned that I just spent time with Horst and some of the other folks that originated the International Open Podcast in Vienna, and you were supposed to go to Vienna just, what, how long ago?
Yeah, just a month ago, and I...
For what?
For being a part of this big conference called Mapping Memories.
Mapping Memories?
Mapping Memories, yeah. And it was all about how should we deal with our traumatic memories in Eastern Europe. Because, of course, we have a lot of these things, you know, especially in post-Soviet countries.
Mm-hmm.
And I really look forward to this because I know that it would be like a huge conference. I've never been in Vienna. I'm a big fan of this Linklater movie, which, you know...
Oh, yeah, Before Sunrise.
Before Sunrise.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I, like, on the last day, I was just lying in the bed, completely out of my mind. Yeah, and so now I'm just sending them a lot of medical certificates, which... because they needed, because they paid for my plane ticket.
As if you were trying to get out of going somewhere you really wanted to go.
Yeah, yeah.
That just makes it that much worse. They're grinding in the night.
Yeah, yeah, really, really. For me, it's absolutely, you know, like Woody Allen situation. I'm not only missed out. I have to deal with a lot of problems because of it.
Yeah, Kafka also comes to mind. But were you able to follow some of the conference online? Was there enough of it? Did they have any video, like, in real time or near real time, or were there some things that you could do at that time to feel at least a little bit connected to it? And
yeah, I'm sure they had, but actually I'm not, you know, that important part of this conference, so I think they have to deal with it without me, and it was more or less okay for them. But sometimes, especially in Memorial, we had these kind of problems because, you know, now in Russia, maybe for 4 or 3 years, we started to have really, you know, big problems with the visas for the guys, you know, all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe one or 2 years ago, we've had this big problem with the guy from Albania. He just couldn't, you know, have a visa to Russia, and all the conference was with this big screen. This guy sitting in his
Big Brother, like the Apple commercial for the Macintosh.
Yeah, and he talked like half Albanian, half English, and our translator sitting in the memorial and tried to catch his Albanian words and translate it into Russian, and we have this strange mixture between Albanian, Russian, and English, and it still was very, very Kafkian, but still very cool.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it a lot.
Have you been able to watch some of... did they record some of the sessions so you could sort of hear some of the lectures and
Yeah, I think so. I think Memorial have... I'm sure Memorial have his own YouTube channel, and they put more or less all interesting videos, like, online.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I meant for the Vienna conference that you missed.
The Vienna conference.
Were you able to kind of...
A really good friend of mine was there, so he basically, like, he Skyped me every day after the... it was so cool, you know? It was with the music and therapy, it was, like, happening in, you know, a little bit with John Cage style, and you missed everything. Okay, I'll be the thing.
Is that an annual conference, or was this a special
I'm not sure, but I think it was a special one, because it was really huge, like...
Yeah.
50 participants from all around the world, something like that.
Do you have a sense of how big the audience was, like the number of participants?
I'm not sure. I think the more, maybe near 100 people.
Mm-hmm. Overall.
Overall.
What do you think of conferences in general? Like, because of my background in writing a book and doing a lot of teaching with technology, I find it really useful to go to conferences for meeting people who think beyond their region or their country, and I'm growing a lot from that, but I wonder about other disciplines, how much value there is, especially with the cost and where the ruble is right now. And I imagine you have to really weigh the cost and the benefit.
I think it's a very hard question. Probably, I don't know, you tell me. I think in your case, it should be more like workshops or not. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more useful in that way, because when we talk about historical conferences in Russia, from my experience, they were more or less crap, all of them. Because,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, because if it's something really interesting, or if it's just like very gifted or talented guy, like talk something really, really good, you wanted to hear it like half an hour, you wanted to read his book or something like that. And, you know, my experience is that you have like 7 or 10 or maybe 15 minutes, and it's not good enough. And there are a lot of, you know, protocol stuff that you have to deal with, the hours, with the like dinner in time, with all these questions, which is not question, but like I just want to say that blah 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 blah,
yeah.
And it's not
yeah.
the question, and
yeah.
it takes us, you know, just like in completely different direction that this really bright guy like just like told us for 10 minutes, and so on. At the same time, I really don't know how to deal with some of my stuff, because sometimes I have this, not like maybe article or some like bunch of ideas that I want to share with people,
mm-hmm.
and I have no other. Sometimes I have no other way to do it, and I have some places that I think are quite good for this. Especially I want to mention, special mention for European University in St. Petersburg.
Yeah,
they're really great. And in that university I have 2 quite good conferences, and this place I like. But
were those history specific?
It's a humanitarian university. They have anthropology part, historical part. I think they deals with literature, with sociology, with politology.
But the conferences there,
the
were they humanities conferences, or were they sort of more specific to history?
They've had a lot of different ones, but I was twice in the conference called, like in Russian it's Konstruiruya Sovetskaya, it's like constructing Soviet. Like we tried to construct Soviet from our time and
mm-hmm.
and so on. Yeah, and they're quite good. Quite
cool. And is there a project that you're working on now or one that you're working towards working on? Is there something that you're really excited about doing that you might like to share a bit about?
Maybe just a little bit, because it's about sports.
Ah.
I know that it's a forbidden theme for our podcast, but.
No, I just said earlier that if we if there were podcast episodes that were exclusively about sports, I wouldn't be in the room.
Okay, but
I'm not against sports.
Yes.
I'm just against personally talking about them, because I have no knowledge.
Okay, but I think it's story worth sharing.
Yeah.
There is this guy. He's from Brooklyn, New York.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Bob Edelman. He's a historian. And he wrote a couple of really, really great books about Soviet cultural sport history.
Oh, wow.
And when I was in the university and I made my, now in Russia we call it, it's diploma. It's like a paper that you should do just to finish university.
Like diploma? Diploma?
Yeah, my diploma, yeah.
Yeah.
And my diploma was about cultural influence of football or soccer in the Soviet Union in the 30s.
Huh.
During this, you know, very, very, very hard Stalin's times with terror, purges, and so on. And maybe 1 week before I have to just, you know, put it and just have to finish it. I've read Bob's book, and I was shocked because all my ideas was in that book. Just
wow.
All the citation, all the quotes was from the same book, in the same direction, and I was really traumatized because I realized that every person which will see my work and his book completely will just realize that I just stole all my ideas from his book. I was amazed, and when I read his second book, which was a lot more painful because it was my own soccer team called Spartak Moscow, and this book called Spartak Moscow: History of the People's Team in the Workers' State. And after it, I just wrote him an email, said like, "You ruined my life. I have to do something with it." And I wrote the first Russian review to his book, and he told me that you're the one, you're that guy. I wrote that
that's
book
so cool.
Just especially for you, because you just have only you realize how I did it.
Wow.
And so on.
That's why you have to go to New York so
meet
him.
Yes, I met him twice here in Moscow.
Oh, cool.
He is a good friend of mine now. And now I'm working for the open translation for his book because I have no contract with any publishing houses, but I have my own blog on the Big Sport website, and I make some kind of open source translation.
So does he own the rights to the book?
We together with him we wrote a letter to his Oxford University Press guys. And they said that I want to make it, I want to publish it for free people of Russia. Let Sergei do it.
Yep.
And I'm on the way.
That's so cool. So, when did you start that project?
6 or 7 months ago.
Mm-hmm. So we can link in the show notes to. So, is it available for people to read parts of it as you're translating
it? Sure, but it's all in Russian.
Well, I'm hoping there'll be some Russian speakers.
Yeah, sure.
The real hope that I have is that maybe we could establish an ongoing podcast, because it's International Open Podcast. The idea is that it will grow beyond just being one or two or three people in one city.
Mm-hmm.
So meeting someone like you really made me think, this is great. I couldn't imagine a better person to be exploring history and pop culture and all sorts of cool stuff here. And particularly the fact that you just said the magic words, open translation. So the fact that you're sharing this work. And I think that's really an important model that maybe there are other fans who could reach out to authors and say, your work isn't available in my country, in my language, particularly when someone's writing about your country, like about your history, and it just makes me think, wouldn't it be great if we could somehow help foster that as part of...
That would be really great, because my lead idea was that I'm really tired of being alone with this book in this country. I have to talk about it. I have to just sharing some ideas about it. And now with this blog with near 1,000 subscribers, I have this experience of, I read the comments. Some of them are good, some of them are not good, but it made me think a lot about how should we deal with this kind of ideas and this kind of books here in Russia.
Do you have a lot of involvement with sports and history? Are there other things that you do tied to your background in history but applying it to sports?
It's really hard to tell, but the main thing is that all this sports or even sports cultural history is very, very dubious in Russia, because even in United States or in Europe, sometimes even now when you talk, I'm just sports historian or something like that, it's blah blah blah, it's very funny, But it's not so serious. Mm-hmm. But I think when we talk about cultural sports history, especially in post-totalitarian countries, it's very, very useful because, you know, basically in Stalin's era we have no free public culture. We have no freedom in, you know, freedom of speech for sure. We have no this like kind of expression in movies or in literature, but sports was a different case. Because, mm-hmm. you know, with all this spontaneity, you know, with all this, you know, a lot of involvement of millions of people, my main idea is that sport is some kind of superculture, in especially in Stalin's era, when you have basically nothing to do with, you know, the high culture, you have to do something with this kind of more grounded culture.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Very interesting. Have you read Fever Pitch?
True.
What do you think of it?
I like the book. Maybe not so much as Bob, because Bob Edelman, he said that it was one of his big influences.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he liked it a lot. Maybe I read it in Russian. Maybe we have not so great translation. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Because Bob is a very big influence on me, and he said that Fever Pitch is like great book.
I can definitely say that Nick Hornby as a writer is one of the better of this sort of, I don't know if I would call him pop fiction. He's in that gray area between pop literature and literature. Like, you know, he's like Zadie Smith, I think, is in a similar, mm-hmm. another British writer, same uh-huh. sort of generation. He's a phenomenal novelist. I'm incredibly fond of a novel of his called How to Be Good. It's maybe my favorite of his. I've read three or four of his novels. How to Be Good is really interesting because it's exploring religious fundamentalism and sort of hippie or like cult-ish. Like, what is it that draws an average middle-class suburban husband mm-hmm. to a would-be cult leader? It's sort of at the heart of that book, but told through the eyes of the wife, who's very skeptical of mm-hmm. not just this cult leader, but of religion in general. Like, she's definitely a humanist. Uh-huh. And so it was really great. I think it's one of his only books not made into a film
uh-huh.
because of yeah. religion.
Yeah,
like, maybe. That topic is not one that any studio is going to be taking on anytime soon.
Yeah, so we have that, I think, kind of, from my perspective, kind of crappy movie with Hugh Grant, but very good movie.
Oh yeah, about a boy.
About a boy, but I really...
It's not bad. Really? It's not bad.
Maybe it's my personal...
But the book is much... It's a great novel. Really uh-huh. great read.
Uh-huh. And High Fidelity.
Yeah, High Fidelity classic.
Yeah.
And I like the film quite a bit too. The book is really...
Yeah, yeah. I like the movie probably because of Jack Black.
Oh, yeah.
The book was kind of influenced on me, maybe when I was 18 or mm-hmm. 19.
Yeah, I think what you would enjoy, I wonder if they're available online. Do you know that Nick Hornby is a music critic and a book critic for Believer magazine? Do you have that magazine here?
I don't think so, but we've had a Russian translation of his book called Thousand Songs or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
And it was about all the important songs for him, and it really was like his musical critic thing. And actually, it was a little bit too pop for me.
Yeah, I haven't read that.
Yeah, it was like big parts of it was about Nelly Furtado or Bruce Springsteen, which is like a little bit like too pop for me, but still.
Sure.
I like his style anyway.
I think you would enjoy reading some of the column that he has, or the series that he has in Believer magazine. I think it's called What I'm Reading,
mm-hmm.
and it has some really fun Hornby-esque
mm-hmm.
sort of affectations. Mm-hmm. Like, he lists the five books, the books that he's bought as well as the books that he's reading.
Uh-huh.
So it's sort of, and he makes fun of himself a bit because sometimes he's sort of readily admitting that he's not gonna, he's never going to read this one book. Like, he bought it, probably won't read it, or there'll be a book that he started to read and he's not getting into it. And when Believer Magazine began, it grew out of McSweeney's, which is a really cool, you've heard of it, this sort of literary journal, but with this sort of attitude, like a punk rock literary journal.
Sure.
One of the great crowning achievements of my life was when they published one of my pieces just on their website. It wasn't in their thing, but to have it on the website, and they had it on the homepage for a week, and it was the greatest thing.
Yeah,
it was just one of these humor lists. Like, it was... I'll link to it in the notes, just because I want more people to read the work that I published with McSweeney's. And this is like 2004, I think. I was living on a hippie commune in rural Virginia, and I'd been reading McSweeney's since the beginning, and like really would read every bit of it. And one day it just popped into my head, this idea, something like an alternative to the Ten Commandments. It would be, what if there were more than Ten Commandments, just like in the Mel Brooks movie, where he goes from like 15? But I thought, surely the Lord would revise his work. So these are the commandments revised out of the... And so I had a lot of fun doing that. But the what made it most successful is that this girl in high school I had the biggest crush on and went on one date with, and she went to Harvard, I went into the Navy. Like, totally different directions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, wouldn't you believe, out of the blue, I get an email from this now young woman saying, that was hilarious, I saw your piece on Nick Sweeney's. And I was like, she's the only one in the state of Massachusetts that had probably ever heard of Nick Sweeney's.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like,
it
warms my heart. It was really like a high fidelity moment, or like something that Nick Hornby would write. But they published one or two books collating his what I'm reading. And the most hilarious bits are, when they created, so it was Dave Eggers and his team that created Believer Magazine, and they had this idea that they wanted to be different from other literary journals, and they really wanted to focus on pop culture, but in a deep, meaningful way.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this sort of, I don't know if it was written, unspoken, but we don't want bad reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this isn't a magazine where you're just going to tear something apart. So if you're doing a film review, it should be something you're passionate about.
Uh-huh.
And that resonates with me. I like the idea of digging deep into something that's worthwhile rather than just cutting something apart. But if you're doing a ongoing, you know, series called What I'm Reading, what happens when you get to a book that you don't like? So he writes hilariously sort of all around the fact that he hates a book. Like, he can't...
Mm-hmm.
And he's making fun of himself, of Believer Magazine, of having rules for writers. And that's the best writing.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
Very cool.
Yeah. As a book critic, I maybe never have this privilege of writing about books that I don't like, basically. Because if I don't like it, it's not worth mention or something like that. And I have a lot of stuff that I should write about, especially, you know, a lot of historical books, because which I have, you know, very big envy, maybe, because, you know, we basically have no, I don't know how to say it, it's not only websites, you know, no sources to make, you know, a lot of stuff to publish, because, you know, if we have, like, thousands or maybe like hundreds good websites, magazines about literature, history, culture, it would be one case. But now we have basically maybe at least maybe 10 or 12 good ones.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not good enough, because sometimes I have some ideas and I know where should I put it. Maybe on the podcast.
I wonder if you could assemble a list of 5, 10, however many, and we could also link to those. So if people are curious, like, what would be, you don't have to go through them now, but I think it'd be valuable for people to have a list like that.
If you know Russian language, and if you hear, after all, you hear our podcast, for sure you know all these 5 or 10
sure. things. That makes sense.
But still, why?
Do you want to name some now? Like,
sure. our memorial website called Uroki Story, which means like history lessons.
Mm-hmm.
There is this big cultural website called Kolta.
Is that Russian for culture?
Kolta? No, I think it's some. It's not Russian word.
Oh.
It have to deal something with cult, like this this guy,
yeah.
And something with.
Oh, like the Cult 45.
Yes, something like that. Yeah. I don't know. I really like this newspaper called Troitsky Variant. Mm-hmm. It's really geeky one, you know, for the geeky scientists. I really
cool.
like the articles because there I know. In a lot of cases, I just, you know, realize that I know Russian language, but I understand barely like maybe 20% of what I'm reading right now because it's really hard. It's really geeky, but still really cool. And maybe it's my top three, you know?
Yeah, that sounds cool.
Yeah.
I mean, the English language one I was thinking of as you were describing it is Medium,
mm-hmm.
medium.com, which I'm increasingly drawn to.
Mm-hmm.
I like it, and but it's only recently that I really understood what the site was.
Mm-hmm.
Like, somewhere along the way, I read an article on Medium, thought it was fantastic,
mm-hmm.
and then subscribed to their daily sort of list.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really get. I thought it was an online magazine. I didn't get a sense that it was actually a platform
mm-hmm.
for writing. That it's sort of like a WordPress, or
mm-hmm.
but that they also paid writers so that there would be that sense of it being more than just WordPress.
Mm-hmm.
And I like it. I think it's a good mix because you have the really accomplished writers writing long form and short form articles that bring the readers. And then you have writers maybe like us who have the opportunity to rise through readership if we come up with a really compelling piece of writing. And that's a model that I believe in. I think it's not as open as other models, but there's something to be said for expertise. And I think it's a really delicate balance that you need to find between the professional world and the amateur world. There was a book I read several years ago called The Age of the Amateur or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was looking at, or The Rise of the Amateur, I think that's it. With the, now amateurs can produce things very quickly and find a really large audience
sure.
going on a TED Talk or
yeah.
or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But even within the book, they were recognizing that it still takes certain professional, like, exemplars, as we would say in education, like having something that really draws people if you're going to have a community around it or a magazine around it versus, you know, the difference between a zine and a magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I still read New Yorker magazine,
mm-hmm.
and I no longer read Wired magazine.
Mm-hmm.
I now get most of a lot of my cultural stuff, at least in New York,
mm-hmm.
from New Yorker. But I'm not finding it as useful to have a magazine for tech culture because it moves so fast. And
mm-hmm.
Wired in particular used to be a fantastic magazine that you would read cover to cover. There were so many new things.
Yeah, sure.
And now it's really more, like, I think it's gone from this, this is something I've been thinking a lot about recently. When I was growing up, there was this sense of wonder. And for those of us that read science fiction, it was especially intense. And Marvel Comics even had a comic book in that gave me the title, which is, like what if?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
What if something, something, something?
Mm-hmm.
In the comic book, it would be, what if Spider-Man was more spider than man, or something, like,
yeah.
It would be like what could happen? So we went from sort of like the what if thing to what's next.
Mm-hmm.
Like, now it's just about what's the next iteration of a phone or a watch or a computer or.
So you mean we just found the main direction and we just lead in this direction?
Yeah, yeah, I think so. I think that it's. I'm far less excited about what's coming than I used to be. Mm-hmm. And in the 70s and 80s and maybe part of the 90s, I was really a futurist, I think, an amateur futurist, mm-hmm. really thinking, wow, we can transform society, and there are all these possibilities, and you would read, like, Ursula Le Guin or Arthur C. Clarke or these writers, and they were presenting whole different directions that society could go in 1,000 years in the future, and now you go to a science fiction film, and it's just, like, a slight difference, or it's, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure, but you know, in kind of funny way, it took us back to this, you know, Rocky IV stuff.
Cause yeah.
You know, I've read some things about it, which goes like that. When were the times that it was all about the battle between two systems, between Soviet Union system and American system? Yeah. There were more like ideas, like you said, like what if different, you know, ideas, how should we do some things this way or that way. And after crash of the Soviet Union, God bless this big crash, but after it we have more or less one basic main line, capitalistic main line, and all other ideas was more or less dubious or even extremist and mm-hmm. so on. So probably it has, you know, something with this idea. I don't know.
So should we hope that what's going on in Syria escalates so that it will improve our pop cultural choices?
It's a big ask, actually.
Of course, my tongue is as firmly in my cheek as it could be on that.
Yeah.
I was groaning as I was saying it, like.
Uh-huh.
But we were also talking a bit earlier about since I brought it up, maybe to forgive myself for treating something so lightly. You mentioned something that really intrigued me, that you've done some work at a Syrian, not Syrian, but at a Russian or Moscow
mm-hmm.
refugee center.
Yep.
That was some sort of educational initiative.
Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, sure. This is the the main refugee center called Гражданское содействие, which, you know, have to work with all, more or less all refugees here in Moscow. And my work there was that I was a volunteer as a history teacher with their basic school, because, you know, we here have a lot of problems with how our school works, and sometimes if you don't know Russian language, or if you know Russian language but you have no right to go to the public school,
mm-hmm.
basically if you're a refugee, and you can be a refugee here for years and years, and of course your children, you know, they have to learn something.
Mm-hmm.
And for the children, they opened this kind of free school, free lessons, all led by volunteers. And my part was basically history lessons, or just like lessons about everything, because
mm-hmm.
you know, most of them don't know basically more or less anything about history, about, you know, how that the world is round and something like that.
So where would you start? I guess I have a couple questions
uh-huh.
that are related. One is, do you get to choose what you teach? I imagine as a volunteer you have a lot of choice around uh-huh. that. And if that's the case, how do you choose, and what did you start with? Like, which historical period, or what kind of lesson?
Mm-hmm. You know, in my case, it wasn't very hard to choose, because I worked basically with, I think it was like two or three guys and maybe three or four girls
mm-hmm.
from time to time, and they all were from Chechnya. Probably one guy was from Uzbekistan, or maybe one guy and one girl were from Uzbekistan, and so they know Russian language,
mm-hmm.
and we have no this language barrier, and all of them more or less went to school. So my role was just like to explain them all the, you know, this school textbooks that, you know, sometimes they don't, you know, have a goal, you know, they don't know what exactly they're talking about in these books. So we just went, you know, from chapter to chapter, and my main role was just to discuss this thing and just to make the impression that it isn't just so hard, and I'm a normal person, and they're normal guys, and they know, and they will know how to deal with these things. So I think it's more have to, you know, it was more about just like discussing, more about like about maybe psychology, like the idea that they can just be okay with me here in Moscow in this, you know, very sometimes very hard circumstances for them. I think it was more like that. And as far as I understand, the main goal of this school, it's more about like to be okay than just, you know, education.
Sure. Could you give us a sense of the scale of the school, like how many people?
Now I think it's Katya, forgive me if you're hearing this. It's 70 or 80, I think. And
students coming in.
Yeah. And they are from most of them are from post-Soviet Union countries, but some of them are from so-called Black Africa, so like Congo. Some guys are from Afghanistan, even from Syria. I think someone from Cameroon, from even from Ethiopia. You know, from the countries that they have no choice to go right way to Europe or United States, and visa to Russia was less expensive, and they just basically bought a visa to Russia and thought that Russia it's part of Europe. I'm just, you know, heading to Russia, and after it I will cross the border, and it's a nightmare because, you know, a lot of guys just stay there for years because they have no right to go, you know, in Europe, and they have nothing to do here, and it's a very, very, you know, hard thing to do.
Really. Is learning Russian the highest priority for most or all of them, or is it not such a high priority because they're getting that outside of school?
Yeah, it depends, you know. And in Moscow, we have very basic program of how to, you know, how to make these lessons available for these people. And if they want to stay on, or if they have. It's often case of, you know, the people who came from Chechnya or some post-Soviet countries that they really want to like to be there, and they, you know, one case that more or less they will know the language, or if they don't know the language, sure they have to learn it. But I think in Sadyestvo we always had like couple or more volunteers, which, you know, especially, you know, their thing is how to learn the they know. Sometimes French or English, and they have to just be a teacher in Russian for these guys.
Do they have computers or facilities for learning, or is it really a raw? Like, what are the resources? Are books being provided? Are computers, internet access, MOOCs? Are they able to learn?
When I was a volunteer, we've had only, you know, the place to be, and it was really maybe like two or three rooms, and we've had to share it with the whole institution of Гражданское содействие, with administrators, with the lawyers who work with the people, you know, with their problems with the, you know, border law or something like that. So it was really hard. After I left, it was even harder because a couple of months ago, Moscow government took away the license of even of this place from Гражданское содействие, and now it's a big struggle. They try to find a new place and try to find the finances, you know, to work one more year or two. But at the same time, is it often the case in Russia, because of the struggle, they had some publicity. And now I think they had maybe one or two more or less, you know, sponsors who can give them the money like for 1 year or two of working. And with this money, I hope that they will have the computers and the place to be. Mm-hmm. I hope so.
And how did you find out about the refugee center? What was it that brought you there originally?
Of course, it was because of the girl, because I want to impress her. And when a friend.
This is your now girlfriend.
No.
Or another one.
No,
oh.
Another one.
Oh. I take it back.
Yeah,
sure.
It's okay. We will, you know.
We all have those. I have many of those stories of things
for
that
sure,
I did trying
sure.
to impress
for
a girl.
Sure, for sure. So I wanted basically to impress her, and
mm-hmm.
I have a friend of mine who just worked in this organization, and I thought, okay, it's a possibility, you know, to
mm-hmm.
do something good for the people. If I'm not the right person for her, maybe I will be the right person for this people. And
yeah.
So on, yeah. But you know, it's a good way to making something good. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like if nothing else, it made a baby.
Yeah, sure. yeah, sure.
You now have a child who's 4.
Yeah, she's 4.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Vera, which is in English it's Faith.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, old Russian name.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It works. It worked in a very strange way, but it works.
Yeah. And Vera's mother is the former director of the refugee center.
Yeah.
Is that right?
She was a director for almost 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this is a really good plug for volunteering. You should really volunteer in such centers because you never know who the director might be.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
what
yeah.
it will lead to.
Yeah, it's a really good. Yeah, it's a really good place to meet people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know. I've had a lot of friends who worked there before me. I've had some friends who worked after me because of me, because I was like this cool guy that, you know, I worked in this organization.
Oh, yeah.
It's a cool place, you know. I just hanging out with these Chechnya guys and their music and their food and so on. And they're like, whoa, cool.
And do you have friendships that have continued with refugees that you met there?
I don't know if I can call it friendship, but my you know, my first pupil... in that time he was probably 12 or 13. Now he's 18 or 19, and yeah, I sometimes, you know, we hanging out, but you know, maybe once or twice in a month.
Cool. Well, we discussed at the beginning, before we started recording, that at a certain point we would change roles.
Mm-hmm.
We, since it's the open podcast, and you resisted finding out too much about me before, so that you could grill me a little bit the way that I've been grilling you.
Yep.
So why don't we turn? We can keep our seats. Maybe we'll take a quick break.
Yeah, sure.
And then we'll come back, and you can
just
take over. Yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, and. Speak some Russian, maybe.
Yeah.
Sure. Let's
do. Were you speaking English there? Or?
Probably because I was in that kibbutz. That, you know, there were a lot of guys from Australia and New Zealand there.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, they all more or less speak English, and who not speaking English, they speak. Russian, spoke Russian, and I was in the, you know, very great community of the volunteers, and they were mostly from Colombia or Mexico or from India.
That's another good topic for another episode that we could explore, me having lived in a commune in the U.S. and you on the kibbutz.
Yeah, I'm very interested actually in your hippie commune experience.
Did I send you the links of the Russian... news crew that made a documentary about the community?
No.
Oh, it's Moscow. I'll send you the link right now so I don't forget. It's I think it's a pretty major media company in Russia, and they did like 2, maybe 15 or 20 minute. I just sent them to somebody here. Let's see. I think it's Russia Now or R. I'll find the links. Yeah, I was just visiting there again in Virginia in November. I was there for a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I go back pretty frequently. Let's see. Oh, it must have been on Facebook. That's what I don't like about using Facebook as a communication tool, which it seems like is required here. Maybe in part because I'm not on the Russian social network, but I really prefer email for centralized communication. Yeah. And then I use this chat stuff very rarely, for a quick little.
Yeah, but in Russian on Facebook, it's more or less like, I don't know, if you're quite intelligent, if you have, you know, some good friends, you have to be on Facebook. Because if you're not on Facebook, you basically not exist. And that's my experience for the last, 7 or 8 years.
That's what it's looking like to me. Yeah. And that's so different from the way we use it in the U.S.
Sure, sure.
We use Twitter, I think, way more than, for sure. And then we have LinkedIn for the professional communication. We talked about that a bit last time.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think it's, you know, in Russia it's more like, you know, in the Middle East. Because, you know, if we have this kind of revolution, you will be out of revolution if you not use Facebook. You know, you will not.
The revolution will not be televised, but it will be on social media.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Have you read any Marshall McLuhan?
Sure. I know him. I just yesterday, at night, I saw this very, very good documentary. It was about debates between William Buckley Jr. and...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I want to see that documentary. Yeah, it's on Netflix?
It's on
Rebecca. Yeah, I do want to see it.
Yeah, I just...
Because I've seen clips through
clips
the years.
Was trailer was amazing. Yeah. The movie was really great. I know, I liked a lot this, you know, that period of history, that 1968, this, you know, transition from Johnson to Nixon because of, you know, maybe from Hunter Thompson stuff or something like that. And, you know, and that movie was that part of, you know, that Chicago, big riot in Chicago during Democratic elections.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and they, you know, the whole line was like, the whole world is watching, the whole world is watching. Then, they were by police, yeah.
I just saw a trailer last night that I wanted to show you, but now I can't remember the... I can't remember the actor because I can't remember the title, but it's, you know, Stephen King wrote an alternate history book.
I've heard about it.
And I hadn't thought about it at all, even though we were talking about alternate history a lot for the past 2 days.
Yeah.
And now it's going to be a television series on Netflix, or no, not Netflix, on Hulu.
Uh-huh.
This streaming site, but with an all-star cast.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks really interesting. Like, so it's sending this guy back to the future to prevent the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And back to the past.
Yep,
back to the future.
Yeah, it's a different story. Yeah, I've heard that from National Public Radio. I've heard that quite successful was that that show last year.
Yeah.
That it was based on Philip Dick's novel.
Man in the High Castle.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yep.
What if Nazis...
Yeah.
Really,
I watched the whole thing when I was back in the U.S. in November, and it's pretty good. It's not... I think it's being overhyped and overpraised, but maybe because I've read a lot of alternate histories, and they haven't.
Yeah.
To them, they're like, wow, what is this thing?
Yeah.
It has some interesting aspects, and it has some aspects that are a little bit infuriating, because it's... But I'll let you draw your own conclusions, and we'll have to talk about it on a podcast one day.
Sure.
I'm just looking for... I found one of the links for this, the Twin Oaks thing, the commune. And this is Virginia commune. There have been 3 books written about Twin Oaks. 2 of them, though, by people in Twin Oaks, the same person.
Mm-hmm.
And then one very interesting one from the mother of someone that lived at Twin Oaks. It's a much more critical view. Virginia Commune documentary by Russian media. I think I have that right. It's RT?
Yeah.
Russian Time?
Yeah,
Russia Time?
I know. It's общественное российское телевидение, which means like Russian television for the society or stuff like that. And it's not so popular actually. It's like it's. It
I wondered because.
Yeah. it had to be like our BBC, like our public, completely public non-governmental channel. But yeah, after all, it became like this. I don't know. No one knows what is in on this ORT. Yeah.
So this, it was a 30-minute. So it was like a whole episode. Cool. It's pretty interesting. Cool. Mostly my friends. So yeah, let me set it there for later, for exploration. Yeah, I'm good.
Okay.
You wanna dig in?
I just want to start it once again with this.
Oh yeah, nice, nice.
Yep. Okay. Okay. So now we will change our roles.
Yeah.
And I have some questions for Derek.
Cheers.
Cheers, man. I'm really curious, you know, in a couple of things that you said me off air and on air too. And I think I want to start with this hippie community that you mentioned once or twice. What was the story actually? How it all goes? How it all?
So I always want to go back, and I think that's allowed when I'm talking to a historian.
Uh-huh, sure.
When I was growing up, I was really fascinated by the 60s and the hippies movement. And there was one film in particular that captured my imagination when I was a teenager, which is this film Hair. You know, it's the stereotypical, it's all these hippies in Central Park living together, loving each other, singing and dancing, hallucinating.
Uh-huh.
And I was also really interested in communism. I didn't really know what communism was. I didn't know the differences between socialism and communism. But I had this deep fascination with the idea that people would live and work together, this alternative to consumerism and capitalism, growing up in the 70s and 80s. And I think that the mid to late 80s were one of the high points of that capitalist era for the United States. At least that's how it felt to me. Well, I end up going into the Navy because I didn't have good enough grades or family wealth to go to college. And when I was in the Navy, unfortunately, a war breaks out in Kuwait, and we're sent to fight in Kuwait. And while I'm on a battleship in the Persian Gulf, somebody says, "I have these magazines I think you might like." Because I was definitely one of the alternative guys on the ship. And so he hands me a couple magazines, and it was Utney Reader, U-T-N-E.
Mm-hmm.
And so Utney Reader is a really interesting magazine because they don't publish original articles.
Mm-hmm.
At least as I understand it, and I don't know if it's still the case, that it was an aggregator. It's a print magazine in newsstands, very popular with high distribution, but it's mostly reprinting articles from other small presses and alternative presses.
Mm-hmm.
And it blew my mind. I'd never seen anything like this, never read a lot of these points of view before. So it was one of the lifelines that I had, I think, while I was deployed on a battleship at sea for months on end.
Did you have a choice to go or not to go to the war?
I enlisted in the Navy, so I wasn't drafted, but I didn't have a choice about actually going to Desert Storm.
Mm-hmm.
I was stationed on a ship, so it was pretty much the ship's going there, so you're going there. But also, when we left for the Persian Gulf, we didn't know there would be a war. Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait, but George Bush Sr., the first George Bush, in 1990, did his famous speech with the line, "I have drawn a line in the sand," and with the idea that he set an ultimatum: if they didn't withdraw their troops, America was going to invade with the support of the UN. So this UN force, with most of the military might coming from the United States at that point. So when we went, we left in November. So that was 2 months before any open conflict. So we really didn't know we were going for war. But to be perfectly honest, I was absolutely hoping for war. Mm-hmm. Because it's what I'd been trained to do. It's what I'd been conditioned to expect. We were going over there as sailors with
no ribbons on our chest. And you see military people in the movies, and usually they have like rows of ribbons, the generals. And so in the Navy, it really is this gamification. It's like badges that's so popular in education.
I've heard a lot of this stuff a lot, you know, in Israel. Because you trained a lot and you just want to explore it. To deal something with.
Yeah, it's not... I don't think anybody ever wants to kill other people. True. It's not about that. But it is that hunger, that war thirst. I definitely felt it going over there. I was really excited that we were going to see action. Like, that was the thing. We're going to see action and get some ribbons, get some medals maybe. Not just ribbons, but... So didn't know what was happening. And I really became radicalized during the Gulf War, so during Desert Storm. It being there and seeing what was happening from the inside and then processing it on the downtime was how it really cemented my worldview, at least in terms of war and military might, the military machine. So very quickly I started to realize that I was adamantly opposed to that war and adamantly opposed to most, if not all, war. It was something that I felt so strongly that I began the process for filing for conscientious objector status while I was still on the ship. It was something that I pursued. It's a formal process you have to go through. But again, to be totally honest, part of me still... There was some mix of responsibility. I wouldn't want to do anything that would threaten the lives of the men that I was on the ship with. And I had a pretty big responsibility running a target designation system, which was really mostly about defending the ship. So if I sort of crossed my arms in combat engagement center and said, I'm not touching those buttons, that would put at risk my friends and my colleagues. And so I never did I think I'm going to like go on strike on the ship. Part of me, the ego part of me thought, well, maybe it would have more impact. I would get press. I would get it wasn't about notoriety, but I would sort of get the word out if I was a war veteran. Mm-hmm. So I thought I'm going to start filing for conscientious objector status now with the hope that when the war is over, when we're back in the U.S., then I will actually be a conscientious objector. And I would have that experience at the root of it. But the war was over so quickly. It was literally, it was less than 2 months. And interestingly, what's the date today?
10th of January.
Okay, so the 16th of January is the 25?
Yeah, sure.
Is that right? 25-year anniversary of the bombing of Baghdad by my ship and many others. So, yeah, that's weird. Next week, it will be 25 years. Yeah. I'm 45 now, or about to turn 46, and so I don't often think in those big chunks of time. That's a lot of time. I was only 20 years old then, so I've been alive longer since. Really weird. But the question was about the hair and commune. Yeah. How did I get to the commune? Well, it is directly related because one of those Utney readers had an ad in the back they were advertising the Federation of Egalitarian Communities. And it is a small group of communities. At that time, it might have been 6 or 7 communes. They don't really refer to themselves as communes because that has its own connotations and it's more about the hippie movement or somehow tied to communism, and that was something that was really not okay in the 80s. So they started using this term intentional community, a community that's been created and also has certain intentions built in. Today we would refer to a community like Twin Oaks, the community that I ended up joining, as an eco-village, because it has sustainability and a deep ecology at the heart of how they live, even though that's not really necessarily part of the bylaws. It's become part of the ideology, I think. But this Federation of Egalitarian Communities, it was this little ad, and it said just enough to give me some understanding of what it was. And I remember, I can't tell you what day it was, but I can remember my first thought was, my God, if I knew these things existed, I wouldn't be here right now.
Sure.
I'd be in one of those communities. And so they were advertising this brochure, this free brochure. So I wrote, sent away, and I don't remember, I had the brochure on the ship, but I'm pretty sure I had it on the ship. So I must have gotten it. When we left for the Persian Gulf in November of 1990, the war began mid-January, like the 16th or 17th, depending on which side of the international dateline you were on.
Mm-hmm.
On the 16th of January, and the war was over by mid-March, maybe even the first or early second week of March, because my birthday is the 28th of March, and we had left the Persian Gulf and were actually crossing the equator on the way to Australia when I turned 21, so I have a pretty good sense. And then we returned to Long Beach, California, where that was where our ship was from, by mid-May. So mid-May, we're back in the U.S., celebrated, parades, all these people are atoning for not welcoming back the Vietnam veterans. My father was a Vietnam veteran, so that sort of went through my head. But sometime between then and when I left the ship, about 6 months later, I got this catalog. Not a catalog, a brochure. It was maybe 20, 30 pages with descriptions of each of the communities in this group. And these were all communities that had certain things in common. They were income-sharing communities. They were egalitarian, so they were called, it's the Federation of Egalitarian Communities because they're communities committed to valuing all work equally. So everybody contributes, and the work that they contribute is valued the same, whether it's running a hammocks business or washing dishes. It's literally valued the same. Everybody gets a set wage, and then it's more about putting the time into your work versus output.
Yeah.
And the third piece, which I don't know if it mentioned it in the brochure, but that certainly spoke to my heart, is committed to nonviolence.
Mm-hmm.
So those three tenets, Twin Oaks was created in 1967, and the three bylaws, or the three, do they call them? I mean, bylaws are actually a thick binder of all sorts of things, but the three core beliefs or values of the community are this, that they're egalitarian, they're income sharing, everybody's pooling their resources, and they're committed to nonviolence, not just physical violence, but also emotional and verbal violence, that kind of thing. So let's fast forward a little bit. I'm in the Navy for another year. I end up leaving the ship, going to another technical school, but was having all sorts of physical health problems. I had the equivalent of a really deep bronchitis for 9 months after Desert Storm. And went through all the medical, I was on antibiotics for over 6 months straight. They tried different antibiotics for months at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that military hospitals worked at that time, or when we would go to sort of sick call, they would say, oh yeah, we don't know what this is, try an antibiotic, come back in 30 days. You go back in 30 days, yeah, we still don't know what it is, try this one. Then they'd start doing some tests. And I'll never forget, they did a test once. They did these x-rays, these brain scans. And they said, oh, wow, I don't know what that is. Here, come back in 30 days.
Yeah.
Like, what? So that process sort of, I think, probably amplified or accelerated the post-traumatic stress that I was feeling from being involved in active combat. And I really did, I lost my mind. I started hallucinating, I started becoming paranoid, and that led to being in a military hospital for 3 weeks, first for evaluation, and then diagnosis, and I was ended up diagnosed as, they call it schizophreniform disorder.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first stage towards diagnosing you as schizophrenic. It was just enough that I would be discharged from the military with a medical discharge and even the possibility of some benefits or some pension or something. So it was one of the greatest things that could have ever happened to me. If only it had happened a year or two sooner.
I think it was the case with Jack Kerouac, actually.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He was an enemy, and he has, yeah. He had this kind of, you know, early stage of schizophrenia.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep, he was a big hero of mine. I read On the Road on the Battleship.
Yeah.
Jack Kerouac and Lenny Bruce, the comedian,
uh-huh.
was also in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the Navy or was it Merchant Marines? Now I'm a little bit unsure.
Mm-hmm.
But Lenny Bruce, yes, he was in the Navy. And what Lenny Bruce did is he wanted to get out so badly once he'd been put on a ship that he started wearing a dress and parading yeah. around the ship every day, just like Colonel Klinger in MASH. And yeah, those were some big heroes. I read his book, How to Talk Dirty and Influence People, while mm-hmm. I was in the Navy,
mm-hmm.
because of it was, I think it was referenced in the film Pirate Radio
with I like
Christian
the
Slater.
Yeah,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, it was a really interesting movie for its time. It had a big impact on me,
uh-huh.
and I'm pretty sure I saw that maybe my first year in the Navy.
Uh-huh.
So pretty great. That and Heather's is another really good one that kind of goes along with it. That was a little bit earlier than uh-huh. that. I think if I'd seen Heather's when I was in high school, I would have been that. I would have been like, I would have got the trench coat and all of that. But so I got out of the Navy with a medical discharge, and one of the great benefits, not only did it get me out of the Navy 2.5 years earlier than I would have been, I was in for 6 years. They require you to sign up for 6 years to go into the more sophisticated technical fields, because you have to get 9 to 18 months of training to do electronics. So I was a fire control technician working on fire control weapon systems. So we had to go to radar school and computer school and all of that. So I got out in May of 92, so about a year, almost exactly a year after we got back from the Persian Gulf. And because of the disability, I was eventually given the schizophrenia sort of label that qualified me for just enough benefits that I could apply for a full scholarship through the Veterans Administration, and in fact got that and ended up going to college for free for 4 years. There's this great myth
mm-hmm.
that the myth is called the GI Bill.
Mm-hmm.
This myth says, if you join the military and serve your country, we'll pay for college.
Yeah.
It is not true. What they do is, if you sign up for the GI Bill, you put your money in, and they match your money and put a little more. And at the end of 3 years or 6 years or 9 years, depending on how long you've been in, you have some money to pay for college. But some of it's your money, and it's not enough for 4 years of college. It wasn't enough back then for one full year of college. Now I don't even think it's enough for one class or two classes at a college like MIT or somewhere. Like, so it's a myth that really infuriates me
uh-huh.
because so many people, and I was one of them. My parents, I was because I didn't go into the Navy directly after high school. I kind of worked for a while. To be honest, I actually traveled with a carnival for 6 months. I wanted some adventure like Jack Kerouac.
Yep.
But then I had a job in a mall, like a shopping mall. One day I come home from work and there's a Navy recruiter in my mother's living room. My mother had called the recruiter and invited the recruiter to the house
mm-hmm.
to get her son out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so, but she and my father really, they really thought this would be a great idea because it would give me discipline and I'd learn
yeah.
a trade. And I would get to go to college on the GI Bill. Another thing that's important to know is I don't know if I would have qualified for that scholarship had it not been for the war. So there also had to be declared a war because many states, including Massachusetts, where I'm from, passed laws after Desert Storm making public college tuition free for veterans
mm-hmm.
of Desert Storm, which is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, that was only tuition, not fees and equipment and books and all that. But the scholarship that I got covered everything. As long as I went to a state school, I couldn't go to a private institution. but ended up going to the University of Massachusetts and got a fantastic education. But I had a year between when I got out of the Navy and when I would start college.
Yep.
So it took many months of process to go through this whole transition before I qualified and got the scholarship. When I finally got the scholarship in the spring of 93, I also got a lump payment from the military for like the back pay when I got my diagnosis for schizophrenia. So I got whatever it was, some thousands of dollars US. And I decided that I would take some of that money and travel across the country. And what better way to explore this world of intentional communities than by leapfrogging, by visiting different intentional communities all the way across the country.
Yep.
Fortunately, in May of 93, there was an international intentional communities conference at Twin Oaks, where I would end up joining many years later. So I could drive to Virginia and meet people from communities from all over the world. So mm-hmm. It was like going to a conference for intentional communities.
Yeah.
And that was one of the most intense, wonderful experiences of my life. I think it was a long weekend, 3 days.
It wasn't like my historical conference.
Not exactly like what you described. Well, in part because I wasn't homesick. So maybe it would have been if you were there. It was also in the woods, not in a city, and clothing was optional, which I don't think was the case at your history conference.
More or less.
Maybe by the end of it, after they'd had enough beer, then the clothes started coming off. But it was really great. I met so many people, and talk about, I was so starving for intellectual stimulation, conversation, education, support, that whole time that I was in the Navy, and for a lot of the time after. That was incredible. In fact, I stayed in Virginia for a full week. There was another small community forming nearby called Acorn. So I was at Twin Oaks for the days of the conference, and then met some people from Missouri that lived at a sort of another community in the Federation of Egalitarian Communities that I was going to be visiting. So I arranged to drive cross country. I had my car, so they would ride with me, and then they would be my hosts in this other community in Missouri. But they'd already arranged to spend time at this new community in Virginia, so we spent a week there and helped with gardening and anything that needed to be done, washing mason jars from the root cellar that hadn't been used in years at this old farm. And one of the lovely things is some of the people that I met there during that time became friends of mine 12 years, 15 years later, whenever it was that I made it back there. And in one case, she's become a very dear friend, and I didn't recognize her at first. Our friendship re-began, and then we realized that we had been connected. So it was really cool. So that's 1993. I did, in fact, drive cross-country. I had a 67 Mustang, which is the perfect car from the outside, like this great, iconic American car white, not red.
Whoa.
And it wasn't a convertible as it should have been.
Uh-huh.
And it was on its last legs. So, it broke down a few times and I'd be stuck somewhere. But I visited 3 or 4 communities on the way out. But Twin Oaks in Virginia is the oldest, biggest, most successful. But it had the population there was in the mid-40s, 40 years old as an average age.
Uh-huh.
And I was 23. So that community didn't really appeal to me very much, though I liked a lot of the aspects that I saw. But when I was at this community called East Wind in Missouri, that really appealed to me. I fell in love with a few young, beautiful young women there. They had a much younger population. They had a somewhat more open, definitely more hippie feel to it. More of a pagan aspect to connection to the earth. And so I learned, that summer I learned a lot about paganism on that journey. But I really wanted to move to East Wind. Absolutely, if I didn't have the scholarship, there's no question in my mind I would have moved there. I wouldn't have gone any further. But I thought, I've gone through all of this to go to college.
Yeah.
It would be, not only would it be crazy for me not to at least try college, but I would be more valuable to the community once I had a college education. This is my thinking. And I still think that was true. So instead, I did go made it my way back to Boston, went to college. That winter, we have winter vacation, winter holidays. I did actually fly to East Lynn and spent more time at East Lynn and liked it even more. And I was like, oh, I really want to be here. Yeah. But the more that I got into my studies, the more it engaged some of the sort of ambitions that I had for making films, writing books. So I kind of... I set aside that idea of commune, and especially I did stay in touch as much as I could and as long as I could with some of my friends in Missouri, but then they gradually started leaving the community, and that just meant that it wasn't as appealing as it would have been. So I graduate from college in 1997. I want to say something. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest benefits of delaying going to college by 5 years. So I graduated from high school in 1988 and I started college in 93. Virtually all the people that I went to high school with graduated from college and got their bachelor's degrees in 1992. Mm-hmm. Because I started in 93 and was there from 93 to 97, I entered that college with no email address, mm-hmm. never having surfed a web page, no access, there were no consumer digital cameras, audio players, almost nobody had cell phones, mm-hmm. only sort of business people had cell phones in 93, and virtually no students had laptops, very few. My first 9 months, most of my first year I didn't have a laptop, I had a portable word processor, and that's all that it did. And so this becomes really important because by the time I graduate from college in 97, I've studied digital music production, 3D animation, web development, graphic design, motion graphics, all this stuff that almost didn't exist.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, that was one of the greatest outcomes that could have happened, the fact that I got that delay happened, because I'd been really into computers when I was younger. Like, even in the late 70s, early 80s, when very few people had access, I was one of those geeky kids that saved up and got a computer and had the great privilege of... I grew up on the edge of Boston, so I was able to go into MIT and take programming classes mm-hmm. when I was in, like, 8th or 9th grade. So, 1983, I'm 12, 13, 14 years old taking these classes at MIT. Like, really cool. But that didn't continue. And then being able, that was all sort of re-engaged when I was in college. So that spun me out back into the wide world. Eventually I find my way into teaching and web design and then start developing TV shows and worked. I had a career in Hollywood for 3 years. I worked in a television station, first doing web design and then getting into media production and eventually creating some TV shows that were never put on the air, but that I put a lot of myself into. And then finally, one of the shows that I was just about, I mean, I spent all this time, it was an educational TV show, and not only did I get approval from the station to move forward with it, but I found a sponsor for it. They were going to be the sole sponsor. We were given the green light to shoot the pilot for it 2 days before 9/11. And 9/11, after that, for 6 to 9 months, the television station became Terror Watch Today. Yeah. It's Condition Orange. Condition Orange. Like, all that stuff. And then, during that period, also, the multinational corporation Viacom bought our television station. Uh-huh. We were the second largest independent television station in the country, and all of a sudden, we're just part of Viacom. And they literally started combining us with the CBS affiliate, the mainstream network in Los Angeles. And it was clear that my job was going to be much more about managing mm-hmm. a department. That's just not what I wanted to do. But just as I was sort of thinking I wanted to leave, I'm at the library, and what book do I pick up? Is it Utopia yet? The story about Twin Oaks Community, written by one of the founders of Twin Oaks. And that book really convinced me to reconsider. So I wrote to those two communities again, East Wind in Missouri, Twin Oaks in Virginia, and went to Twin Oaks. Never actually got to East Wind, because it turned out in those years I'd gotten older. So by now it's 2002. I'm 32 years old, and the community's average age had gotten younger. Mm-hmm. So it turned out now when I went and did a community like that, you do a 3-week visit as a way to sort of try out the community. Mm-hmm. You work with the community, and it also gives them a sense of who you are, what your work ethic is. Mm-hmm. Work is very important in a community where you're pooling your resources. So I spent 3 weeks there and knew within 1 week that's where I wanted to be. Absolutely. And I had to go away for a month. They have... They want to make sure that you have time to reflect and the community has time to reflect. So I went away and I visited there for the first 3 weeks of January of 2003, and I ended up joining Twin Oaks, I think it was March 1st of 2003.
And what is exactly the joining process? Do they have to some kind of just like put you or just elect you that you can be a part of the community?
And in the last week of your 3-week visitor program, there's a process that involves a long interview with three people. There's a team. There are a lot of groups and bureaucracies.
Yeah.
There's a bureaucratic process.
Sure, sure.
So they have like a new member team. Is that what it was? Or membership team?
Mm-hmm.
I'm forgetting which team. There was a new member team. Well, whatever. It was sort of like what we're doing right now. There'd be three people, and they ask you 25 questions, maybe, and a lot of it involves you telling your life story. I think maybe you tell your life story, and then they ask you these questions.
Uh-huh.
And some of them they go, "Oh yeah, you covered that one in your life story. You covered that one, but this."
Mm-hmm.
And then they make a recommendation to the community. They have an open forum where people can give feedback about, "Oh yeah, I worked with that guy in the dairy shed milking the cows, I didn't like him." Or, you know, hopefully it's more specific than that. But it takes a lot to... Twin Oaks they're pretty open. The group mind, the group process, means that you need some really specific things to be rejected from that. So usually what they'll do is they might do what's called a visit again. It means come for another 3 weeks. We're not sure. We're not sure where you would fit, or we're not sure how we feel about you, or whatever. Even just getting that is not a good feeling.
Yeah,
I know many people that got that.
Yeah, that's very
important. I didn't get a visit again. They actually welcomed me to the community. And once you're in the community, it's a provisional period for like 3 to 6 months.
Uh-huh.
So it means you don't have voting rights,
uh-huh,
and you don't have health care. So it's the community saying, yes, you can come and work with us. You can contribute. You can start to build up a vacation balance, but we want to make sure that it's a right fit before we're doing all the legal things that make you part of this community and where you are affecting legislation and change, because every member has an equal say in decision making in Twin Oaks. All the businesses and all the property and all the vehicles and everything are collectively owned. So.
Yeah,
before you drive the truck, we want to make sure you're
okay. It reminds me of kibbutz a lot, you know.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of people, even at Twin Oaks, refer to their community as an American kibbutz.
Yeah.
There are a lot of symmetry.
It just, you know, I just remember that, you know, that short story. It was my experience with one friend of mine in kibbutz. He was a Colombian,
mm-hmm,
and we worked in a kitchen together and in the canteen. And you know, once he just came to me and told me, you know, like Sergey, you know, I really missed bad people here.
Yeah.
It was that kind of experience, you know, that because all the, you know, that peaceful, you know, this way, like
nice and calm,
yeah,
and
sure, sure,
yeah,
sure. And you know, like yogurt, you know. Every day,
yogurt and granola.
Yeah, you have this feeling that you want, you know, to do something, to destroy something here.
Yeah,
and it's very cool that they, you know, in that time they had this, you know, this volunteer system which worked, you know, a lot, you know, in exactly in that thing that if you want some violence, just ask some volunteers, you know, to do so.
How long were you at a kibbutz for?
As a volunteer, I was just for a couple of months, but after it, I was visited kibbutz like for a couple of times because my cousin was a member of the kibbutz, and after he was in Israeli Navy for like 2.5 years, I came to visit him.
Wow.
Like,
so was your cousin born in Israel?
No, he was just new citizen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. From Russia?
From Russia, yeah.
What would that process be like? Like, how does a Russian move from Russia to Israel and become part of the Israeli Navy?
Yeah, but if we talk about the bureaucratic way, it's very simple.
Yeah.
They have it's kind of dubious law, but if you are a Jew, it's quite simple for you. And my cousin is, he's really a Jew. And for him it was like maybe month or two with his own cousin in, I think it was in Rehovot, near Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. And after maybe a year in a kibbutz, where he worked firstly as a volunteer, and after he invites him to be a kibbutznik, and maybe couple of months later I came to visit him and also became a volunteer, and it was a great time actually when before his duty in the Israeli Navy. And if we talk about the army, I think there were a lot of similarities with your story, because if you have to go to the army, my cousin Grisha, he's that guy that, if I have to go, I want to go to the, to the best department of the army. I want to be the best. I want to be the toughest guy, and, all this Rambo-free stuff. Yeah. And because of that, he finally went to the Navy, and he was in that, small ship near the border to Beirut. And he served for the 2.5 years. It's a long time, really. And of course it's hard. Of course, you have some. He wasn't in any trouble because any military trouble, but it's still very you feel lonely. You feel really sad from time to time.
Yeah.
And I was really happy for him that he finally finished. And we made this also, connection with your story. We made this thing called Shvil Israel, which is, the whole way all around Israel. It's because Israel actually is quite small, but the whole Shvil Israel, it's 1,000 kilometers because it goes.
Yeah, it's a little smaller than either of our countries.
Yeah, really. But really much smaller.
Yeah.
And if you want to make 1,000 kilometers in Israel, you have to go with the circles, like that.
Yeah.
And actually, I haven't finished my trip, which I was still I have some regrets about it. But I was I already had a child who was very little, and after 1 month of doing these circles, I was tired, and I have a lot of stuff to do in Moscow, so I really had to go. And Grisha, he was with his girlfriend, who is now his wife with 2 children. And they together they made the whole trip for the 2 months from from the mountains on the north to the desert on the deep south. And after it, he came back to Russia. And it's now he's in Russia working in El Al. It's this Israeli air company. He used his military skills and also his knowledge of Hebrew and Russian at the same time.
Was he on kibbutz before or after the military service?
Before. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he was.
Did he grow up on kibbutz?
No. He was just maybe for the 1.5 years. Firstly, he worked as a like me. After him worked in a canteen, and after he worked with the cows. This, I don't know how we call it in English, this big farm with the cows.
Yeah, like a dairy or...
Probably it was cow farm with the milking and stuff.
Yeah.
With a lot of computers in it. Mm-hmm. With a lot of, automatic milking.
Oh, wow.
And he was, a guy with,
Yeah, Twin Oaks is not anti-technology, but they don't have any computers in the dairy barn. They do have their own cows for milk. So they provide not only provide all their own milk, they also... pretty much produce virtually all the cheese that they use. So they have cheese processing, they have dairy, they make yogurt, they make all the soft cheeses and the hard cheeses.
Cool.
So that part was really cool. And I've never eaten better. And certainly within maybe 6 months, I was down to the weight I'd been in the Navy. I was at my, like, ideal weight. Uh-huh. And then I lived at Twin Oaks for 2.5 years, a little over 2.5 years. And then within probably 6 months after leaving, I'd gone right back up to the the weight that I am. Not now. I'm probably heavier now than I was back then. But put on the... I was back to square one, sort of. But they produced in summertime, when I was there, the number that we shared was, we said in summer we could produce about 60 to 65% of our own food to feed over 100 people, and sometimes 120. The community really swells in the summer because of the conference and people visiting and friends, and it's a very open community. You can, like, if you were really interested, even if you didn't know me, you could kind of reach out to the community and say, hey, I'm in Russia, I'm a historian, is there somebody there willing to host me? And they would find someone. They'd put up a sign, and someone would be like, yeah, I'll totally host a Russian historian. And you'd be there, you could be there, like, for several weeks before people would start to be like, wait a minute, who's this guy that's not doing any work? Because it is really about work. So you it's wild how much you stand out if you're not working.
Yeah. Like, I have a lot of the same circumstances in the kibbutz. Because the first time I was a guest, and it was cool, but, you know, after maybe a couple of weeks, I realized that I have to work here. Because I started to feel shame when I go to the canteen and took some food.
Yeah.
Everything was more or less all right, but I was like, I don't know. Like, who is he? Ah, he's Grisha's cousin. Ah, okay. If he's still Grisha's cousin,
And it's really true.
Yeah, sure.
And you also, what's great about it is, even if it's work that you don't want to do, you're really getting the community experience by doing the work, and typically you're doing it with other people, and you're getting to know them at a deeper level than if you're just having a conversation. Like, conversation is about intellect and sharing experience and stories and all that, but when you work with someone, you really see who they are. Like, you get this demonstrated. It's like when if you study writing and you do creative writing, you're supposed to show, not tell. You want character to emerge through behavior and choices that the character makes, rather than just describing who they are. And this is the greatest guy. Like, Harry Potter is renowned throughout the wizards and wizards. That kind of thing.
But I think in my case it was some not problems, but some differences because of the language. And my boss in the canteen, actually, he was from Ethiopia.
Oh, wow.
And his English was much more limited than even mine. So he was like, Sergei, do this, or Sergei, clean this, or famously, Sergei, today me sick, so on. But we were really good friends, but, you know, in this, more or less in the sign kind of language, not that we use that we make a podcast or something. That's great. And why did you leave your community?
It's somewhat complicated, but it's easy to share some of the things that were missing for me. One of the big things was I worked harder in the community than I ever did before. I worked much harder at Twin Oaks than I did in the Navy. And the Navy is like slave labor. So it was sort of like slave labor at Twin Oaks. I was doing a lot of intellectual work. I wasn't doing a lot of heavy labor, but the intellectual work really wore me down. And it was, the allowance back then was something like $72 a month. Everyone got exactly $72 a month, but we had our sort of the restaurant for the community that was all free, and cars and all. So we didn't really need much. And it was easy for me to earn some money outside of the community if I wanted to do something like travel, although I really did very little travel. My first year at the community, I don't think I even left other than locally. I did very little I mean, I guess I did go on one sort of road trip with people for a few days to a neighboring town or a neighboring state, I mean, to North Carolina, but never left the country, didn't leave the region during that whole time. But I was working really hard and there was a lot of stress. And as I was doing it, I would see these people not working so hard,
mm-hmm.
not so stressed.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them really not working much, no stress. And I was just, I would get frustrated because they were some of the same people that were arguing that we should be buying all organic groceries.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, great, where's the money coming from? And I became involved not just with the, I worked a lot with the primary business, which was this hammocks manufacturing business. Mm-hmm. I started doing marketing and then eventually was on the general management team and did some, what did we call it? Like for the manufacturing, I would actually do studies about how efficient different departments were and how we could increase production.
And did you feel, you know, this kind of, I don't know how to put it, this kind of disconnection between this capitalistic approach and the whole ideas of...
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it was one of the inherent contradictions in the community. Part of why why Twin Oaks is so large, mm-hmm. geographically, I mean, they had, I think it's 450 acres or something, they're even a little bit bigger now, quite big,
mm-hmm.
really a village, and with some beautiful buildings, a lot of buildings, so dormitories. There were 92 adult members most of the time that I was there. That's the cap,
mm-hmm.
based on the available space.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go to a lot of intentional communities, they're either in cities in very inexpensive buildings, or they're rural in old farmhouses, or kind of thrown together things. But Twin Oaks has this incredible architecture, and there's a sense of design and even a certain aesthetic there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was at least in part, if not large part, funded by this hammocks business. Not just that, it's not like they were selling their hammocks to hippies. From the early 70s, they were selling to a multinational chain, this store called Pier One Imports.
Mm-hmm.
And so Pier One Imports was paying Twin Oaks very little money per hammock.
Mm-hmm.
So Twin Oaks was really like China to them.
Yeah.
And we would, and it was really difficult. So when I started there, as I took on more and more responsibility in the hammocks business, so I joined in 2003, and I wanted to mention another irony. The day that I joined Twin Oaks was the day that the United States started the ground war in Iraq. Again.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was another Gulf War that started the same day. Really weird. But so I joined March of 2003 and I stayed until like the spring of 2005. And I kind of date my time there from when I started my visitor period at the beginning of January, especially
mm-hmm.
because I spent time at another community in between
mm-hmm.
doing work for Twin Oaks,
mm-hmm.
like for their hammocks business
mm-hmm.
already. So even before I joined Twin Oaks, I was doing some marketing work, like web design stuff. When I began there, my whole first year, maybe year and a half, we were still fully dependent on this company, Pier One.
Mm-hmm.
And every year, for many years, maybe every 6 months, maybe every 2 months, whoever was working in the hammocks business, managing it, responsible, would say something like, this is not sustainable.
Yeah.
If Pier One changes their mind, it's going to devastate not just our community, but we started farming out the production of hammocks. So as the business grew, because an intentional community can't hire workers from outside of the community, so that's not an option. What they would do is partner with other communities. So East Wind in Missouri became a big partner with Twin Oaks.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of the relationship through the years between those communities. In fact, East Wind in Missouri was founded by people that came from Twin Oaks. So they wanted to create another community, like clone their community with slightly different values. And then both those big communities still couldn't make enough hammocks.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't demand that people make hammocks. There's other work that needs to be done in the community. So then you start creating these other entities, these smaller communities, or maybe even just people in the community who are ex-members. Mm-hmm. So by the time I was involved, there were all these little satellites, and the way it was structured was so that the big communities could always make as many hammocks as they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But then there'd be enough of these little communities to make all the hammocks to finish the order that needed to go to Pier 1, by and large.
Really tricky.
And so, guess what happened? Well, I'm running the business with a few other people. Pier 1 says, we're not going to be carrying hammocks anymore. Mm-hmm. With no notice. Like, they basically... I can't remember the exact timing. Let's say it's summer of 2004, I think. Summer of 2004, I'm in my room. Every adult member at Twin Oaks gets their own room. That's one of the important things. So even married couples have their own separate rooms, some of them in different buildings, some of them adjoining if they want to, but it's something that was really important. A bit like, have you heard of this book, A Room of One's Own by Virginia Woolf?
Sure.
A really famous feminist book. So, like that, everyone should have a room of their own. So, picture me, I'm in my room, and I've got my power book, and I open it up, and there's an email from Pier 1, and the email says, we will no longer be carrying Twin Oaks hammocks. Like, so, years of people speculating, and I'm just the latest person that's crunched the numbers to try to show the community how non-sustainable it is. Only a few months before, maybe 4 or 5 months before that, with this other, we had a general management team instead of having one general manager. So a few of us on the team started engaging the community, saying, hey, we don't like this, we need to diversify. So I get this email, and that was one of the most intense days of my life. I think it's almost... I could relate it in some ways to when we started firing Tomahawk missiles at Kuwait. Because mm-hmm. with the Tomahawk missiles, because I was a fire control technician, I went to school for 9 months, and I learned how weapon systems work, including the Tomahawk. Mm-hmm. So I had all this knowledge about the Tomahawk, and then I spent a year doing simulations, war games on a battleship. Like, and then all of a sudden, we're firing Tomahawk missiles. So I'm not saying that I knew more than anyone else on the ship about what that meant, but I am saying I'm someone that knew a lot about what that meant. I had a sense way more than just seeing a blip on a radar or that it's history, or like, really had a deep understanding of what was happening. Same thing in Twin Oaks. And it's almost the same timing. It's like I've spent a year working on the hammocks business, and then all of a sudden I'm the one holding this email, and I can remember I had to... post the letter, so I had to walk through the woods from the whole way thinking like, and it's the most complicated thought process imaginable. It's horrified. I'm excited. Yeah. I'm like, this is gonna force the hand of the community. And really, by the time I get to the dining hall, this building called Zankoya, we call it ZK for short, where we have the equivalent of a message board, except it's physical.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm posting this email, and it would be really interesting to see the actual email as it was posted because they would put it on, you put it on a clipboard.
Yeah.
So you put it on a clipboard with blank pieces behind it, and then people just like a message board, right?
Yeah, but, sure.
I don't know if I wrote anything on it. I don't know if I wrote like an introduction or anything. Like, part of me wishes I didn't write anything. I probably had to have written a little something. Like, I didn't want people to just be like, like seeing this Star of David in my scratchbook. Like, you're not ready for it. You're not. So, I don't know. But by the time I posted it, I thought it was one of the best things that could have ever happened to the community. I thought, this is going to keep me in this community forever. Like, now we can really build something that's sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
And but that was about 9 months before I left the community. So what happened is, in the course of the sort of aftermath, community going into crisis mode, and you know, as a historian, now mm-hmm. you have, that's when the big changes happen. You have this thing that forces change. It meant that within about 6 months, I had a sense the community was not going in the direction that I really wanted it to go. And parallel to that, a relationship that I'd been in for a long time ended with someone in the community. And I'd fallen in love with this other person in the community who started a relationship with someone else. Mm-hmm. And there weren't a lot of people my age and with my sort of view of the world, and mm-hmm. I'm kind of an intense guy, so I need to be with kind of an intense person. There wasn't so much of that there. So I was thinking, okay, I don't think they're building businesses in the way that I really want to be involved. I don't see a potential partner, girlfriend, wife. Like, mm-hmm. that was part of why I moved to Twin Oaks. I'm about to turn 35. Mm-hmm. I'm not making money, so it's not like it's going to be easy for me to kind of go somewhere else if I spend another year or two. So I just thought, yeah, I think this is it. And so I wrote a letter to the community saying, giving like 2 months notice, mm-hmm. maybe 3 months. I really wanted to make sure there was plenty of time because I was involved with so much. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, it's a team, so it meant they weren't losing, you know, the community. I have to say, my ego was hurt quite a bit when I saw how easily the community continued without me. Yeah. I was like, what's the community going to do? And there were some people that were, there were definitely a few people that were sort of like, oh, no. Like, there were very few people that tried to talk me out of it, if anybody. Because that's almost an unspoken rule, that you don't try to talk someone into joining Twin Oaks or leaving. But it definitely, it strained, if not ended, some friendships. And that's not rare that would happen. So yeah, that's, I ended up leaving. But I didn't go far. I only went about to the next small city, the city Charlottesville, Virginia. Really, mm-hmm. really historic place. As a historian, you got to come to the U.S., and if you go to the U.S., of course, you'll go to Boston. Of course, you'll go to New York. But before you go to all those other cities, you should really go to Charlottesville, Virginia. Homeland of Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah,
and that's where you have not only Monticello, but the University of Virginia, which he designed. And it was the first secular university in the U.S. I think one of the first in the world. Like, very cool. Mm-hmm. So anyway, yeah, I lived in that nearby city for 5 more years. So I was in the sort of extended community. I still did some consulting for the business in the community. I went back once a week and still spent time with children that I'd been like a mentor. Or they had a thing there that I really loved called primaries. So you were being sort of like an adult friend or companion for young children, but you would get labor credit for it. It was work. Mm-hmm. Although it was one of the only areas in the community where they could only value it at half credit, mm-hmm. because of the number of children, it would have been, the impact would have been really bad on the community, on the economy, if that was one area that they needed to control. And also there were parents that said, you know what, I don't want people doing primaries because they need to make quota. Like, mm-hmm. I want to make sure that they're doing it because it's what they want to do. So I got really close to 2 children. One who was just less than a year old when I joined. I think she was maybe 6 months old or something like mm-hmm. that. Pretty young. And then her brother, who was a few years older. Mm-hmm. So they became, I now think of them as my fairy godchildren. Mm-hmm. And I was just with them. I was just hanging out with them. In fact, Jonah, the 2.5-year-old then, just turned 15. Either 14, 15, or 16. I think it's 14 or 15.
Uh-huh.
15. So I was just at his birthday party in November. Like, literally, since
I was lost in Moscow. Still in the community.
No. Well, this is interesting. Their parents split up in the mm-hmm. community. One of them stayed and one left. So the father stayed. The mother left, moved to the same city where I did. In fact, we shared a house together. She met somebody else, fell in love, and they wanted to have a baby together. And the community said, yet. Mm-hmm. Like, literally, the community, because Promethea had already had 2 children in community, it's, for a long time, the community discouraged anyone having more than 1 child. And then there was a cap at 2. 2 was really pushing it. 3, no way.
Whoa.
Like, because it is a lot of time and money that goes into supporting a mother with a child and a father with a child, a family with a child. And the community does support. I mean, in my country, most women, the most they would ever get for maternity leave is 3 months. Usually it's like, what, 8 to 12 weeks or something? Maybe 6 weeks. And some don't get any.
Yeah, it's the theme of, you know, the scientific theme that which was approached by my girlfriend, actually. When we were in Paris, her work was about how long did you get when you're a mother? What kind of time do you have, like, to raise your baby? And what it goes, you know, if we talk about feminism, which time is good, and because of what are cultural differences between Russia and France because of it, and so on. So I know quite a bit about it, actually.
So then guess how much maternity leave, or I want to reframe it a little bit, how much time do you think a community like Twin Oaks would give a mother to be a mother full-time?
You mean without any labor work?
Yeah, or like maybe modest labor, but where primarily that's what they do. That's their job.
My experience says that like a little time, maybe a month or two, just because it's a commune, you know, and a child is also quite a bit a communal child.
Sure.
So we have to raise him together or her together. So it's just a little time for the like biological time, and after we should put it like a child somewhere, and you should work and like to be with him in the holidays or something like that.
Yeah. So at Twin Oaks, it's more like a year.
Okay. It sounds like...
With big time. Yeah. Although that's not quite accurate, but what they do is they give a full labor budget. So if labor quota, everybody has to do, say, 40 to 46 hours of labor a week, and it varies different times of the year and depending on productivity level and how much money the community has spent, they can flex it a bit. But let's say it's 40 for simple math.
Mm-hmm.
They give a 40-hour budget to the child, kind of, and then the parents can divvy up that time. So it's really cool. It means that the either parent can be the primary caregiver. So it could be the father that actually mostly is a dad for a year or more. And then over time, that 40 hours decreases.
Mm-hmm.
But 3, 4, 5 years old, it's still, I don't know exactly, let's say it's 30 hours. And no. You can give that time to other adults to help you with it. And
cool,
it becomes part of the education. Uh-huh. But it's a lot.
Yeah, but, you know, curiously, but in Russia it sounds not so, I'm not so amazed, just because, you know, we have this, I'm quite sure that we inherit all this stuff from the Soviet times.
Yeah.
Because we have this, you know, more or less socialistic views on it. So, I think you can take like 2 years for sure if you're a mother and you have a budget. I think it depends sometimes of your work, but you can have a budget for this, and
you
can live. But you know, because of the economical situation, it's always in danger.
Yeah,
exactly these kind of things. Yeah, sure. Yeah, cool.
But cool. Yeah, so I left in 2005, and then I left Virginia in 2010. But I still have many, many friends, many dear friends. But the people that I'm closest to are ones who've left and then stayed connected. So when that couple, so these two kids, Jonah and Gwen, their parents split up. They weren't actually legally married, so that makes it a little easier. Their father stays in the community. Their mother goes to a neighboring community. So what they did is started splitting time. So around the time the kids were maybe 5 and 7, it must have been more like 4 and 6 or 5 and 7, somewhere in there, they would divide their time. Part-time in mainstream, it's usually referred to in Twin Oaks. Yeah, or they're in mainstream part of the week and at Twin Oaks part of the week. And for some number of years, they continued to be homeschooled. But at a certain point, the kids really decided that they wanted to go into public schools. And fortunately, both parents really have very similar values in terms of education.
Mm-hmm.
So they encouraged the kids to go into public school. But that meant that then they needed to change the division a bit so that they could be in public school in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So now they're, 4 or 5 nights a week with the mother and only 2 or 3 nights a week with the father, but more time during the summer. And that has seemed to work. I mean, the kids are incredible. They're Gwen skipped a grade 2 years ago, and Jonah is doing like college level math and science, and they're really cool kids, but I'm totally biased.
Whoa. Let's make a small poll.
Yeah. For Sasha. For Sasha. For Sonia.
Mm-hmm. So big chunk of sort of like quasi interview me of you, and then a big chunk of quasi interview you of me that of course got into some really cool dialogue and some great conversation. We covered maybe 10% of what we had hoped to explore in our first podcast together, which is really exciting. It means that we have a lot more to say down the road. So I wonder, you've been wanting to do a podcast for a long time. You bought the microphone before you met me. How is this, is this what you were thinking your podcast would be? Is it giving you ideas for what you could do more consistently in Russia as a podcast or series of podcasts?
I'm not sure yet, but you know, I just thought that it's kind of the medium that I like, actually, because I just want to have something to talk about with this kind of really shiny, bright thing called Blue Yeti. And I just want to have another reason to talk about interesting things, and I want to, you know, to have some people talk about it. And probably I'm a bit tired of writing, or maybe not tired, but I want to do it more in a dialogue way, more, you know, with the spectators and with the people, just with sharing some thoughts and ideas. Probably it's because of that. And also, probably it's because of, you know, it's some kind of, I don't know, neurosis, you know, during my insomnia and other stuff, because I really listen a lot of different podcasts, and, you know, I just realized probably a couple of months ago that I'm really, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts about board games, about non-league football in England.
Could you tell us a few titles? Like, are there a few that you would like to
promote? Yeah, sure. I think it's a really good one called Ludology.
Oh, yeah,
Ludology. About the boarding, like, art of boarding games.
Yeah.
Ludology. Today, we'll talk about faith in, you know, in board games. I love that. It's a really cool one. And also, you know, a lot of Mark Maron, a lot of National Public Radio. I really like that.
Fresh Air,
yeah, with Terry Gross and stuff. I quite like their musical podcast called All Songs Considered.
Yeah.
Bob Boylan, All Songs Considered. And yeah. But I think my favorite one is about actually cultural stuff about football called BBC World Football Phone In. With Dotun Adebayo, this Shakespearean actor from Nigeria, who is their main guy. Really cool one.
Cool.
Yep.
Some of my favorites are, I've listened to Film Spotting for years, which sometimes I love and sometimes it gets me really riled up. Mm-hmm. Not just because I disagree with what they're reviewing, but I disagree with their interpretation of what critique is.
Yep.
I would say they're doing film reviews, not really doing critique.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that there was more critique, and I haven't found the film critique podcast that would really do it for me so far. But I still listen consistently and enjoy it. They had something they used to do that I loved so much. It's one of my favorite games now.
Mm-hmm.
I do it sometimes if I'm on a long drive. For a while they were doing this thing, how would you, they pick a film. And so, like, they pick a film like The Big Lebowski, and they say, okay, The Big Lebowski, if it was filmed in any other time, who would direct it and who would the cast be?
That's cool.
Which is really cool.
Yeah.
And I did several of them. I think the only one that I submitted was Big Lebowski, because I got so excited about what I stumbled on as the idea. So because it didn't make it to the podcast, I want to share it here now. Imagine The Big Lebowski, directed in the early to mid-1960s by Billy Wilder and starring Andy Griffith as the Big Lebowski. I mean, as the dude.
Uh-huh.
And it's really weird at first, but when you think about it, and it turns out, and they, part of the game is that it has to be actors that would have worked with or had or did work with, so like what their cast of characters. And in fact, Andy Griffith was the lead in a Billy Wilder film,
mm-hmm.
which is what, that's how I sort of found him. And I thought, oh, yes, he could totally do it. And then I don't remember the whole cast. I'm not sure I remember any of the cast.
Steve Buscemi of 60s, actually.
I'm going to have to find this. I'm going to find it. And maybe we could resurrect it for our podcast.
Yeah, we
could do it. It could be just not just films. We could do it as an album. Like, we could say, who would do Pink Floyd's The Wall in another time?
Yeah, sure, sure.
Now or something. Like, it'd be kind of cool.
Yeah. We played this, you know, it's not exactly a similar game, but it's also like that we played with my one of my friends. We played, it's kind of handshakes. If you want to handshake, like, I don't know, this Tim Robbins and the, you know, the guy in Russian movie called Konstantin Khabensky. During the handshake, you know, from movie to movie,
he
played in that movie who directed by this guy. Who was a friend of in that guy with that?
We call it 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Okay,
it's a similar game.
Sure.
Where you can do it in 6 steps. Yeah. Although that game is only actors. I like the idea of using directors too.
Yeah.
That's cool. Oh, we should play handshake sometime. Yeah. We'd be really good at beating other people. We should form a team.
Yeah.
Well, on the theme of. Oh, you just said something that reminded me at the beginning that was going to make it such a good end, and now I can't remember what it was. I guess. But as I'm looking at this microphone, if you look at it from the side, it really reminds me of Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
Like the snow walkers. Like, boom, boom. I don't want to do it because it's a microphone and people are hearing it, but it's pretty cool.
Yep.
I guess it was maybe on the theme of pod. Oh, here's what it is.
Yep.
That game is about alternate history.
Mm-hmm.
And we were brought together to work on this history and this entertaining education project or educational entertainment project that you've been working on for quite a bit on the French Revolution. And now I've come in and I might be working on a sort of another aspect of it that involves alternate history.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be really fun to do another podcast while I'm still in Moscow on the theme of alternate history. Because
mm-hmm.
we talked about history a lot today and mm-hmm. shared our own history, so maybe we could explore alternate history and how it's portrayed in film and media, and maybe talk a bit about the project that
mm-hmm.
we're considering working on together. I think that would be really cool.
Yeah, sounds great.
Yeah, thanks.
That's
man.
It. Yep.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Good night, everybody.
Whoop.
До свидания. Oh no, I actually like saying this one. Oh, I forgot it though. I was about to say a leash now, but that's not right. No, could be it.